Welcome everyone, my name is Hua, the host and producer of the Spoken World Podcast, the platform that gives a voice to writers, poets, authors, and enthusiasts from across the globe to share stories that have never been told. We all know about the big story in a book, on a stage, or on a screen, but what is that story that we never get to see? The struggles, experiences, and journey that the writers face before delivering that masterpiece. We discuss that every Thursday on the Spoken World Podcast. On this episode, we're going to be talking about one of my favorite YA series, Gone by Michael Grant, a best-selling book series consisting of 6 books. That was well-deserving. Now, I read this book back in 2015, but it left such an impact that I had to look for the author. But before we go further into the interview that I had with Michael and Daisy, what is Gone about? I'm definitely going to have a lot of fun telling you guys about this book. If I were to put it simply, I'd say, think about the TV series Lost, but with kids that are like X-Men. So one day, everything's good. People are going to class, going about their daily activities, then all of a sudden, all the adults are gone. No proof, they just disappeared. Leaving behind only kids under the age of 15. Things get weird when these kids find out that due to some kind of radiation, they've mutated and have abilities. I'm talking blasting light through your palms, telekinesis, super speed, teleportation, healing anything with a single touch. Let's throw in, you know, something more, you know, interesting, like invisibility and mind manipulation as well, and some other weird things. And then you start to think, maybe it's not so bad without the adult, you know? But then with everyone having super duper abilities, who keeps the peace and make sure that they don't kill each other? What happens when they find out that they are not the only ones that have mutated? Who gets to be in charge now? More importantly, what happens to you when you turn 15? Okay, so I'm going to read an excerpt from the book. It's from book 1. She smelled something foul, sickly sweet and foul. She looked at her shattered right arm. The flesh, especially the taut stretched flesh that barely contained her shattered arm bones, was dark, black edging towards green. The smell was awful. Lana took several deep breaths, shaky, fighting the upsurge of terror. She'd heard of gangrene. It was what happened when flesh died or circulation was cut off. Her arm was dying. The smell was the odor of rotting human flesh. The vulture fluttered to a landing just a few feet away. It stared at her with beady eyes and bobbed its featherless neck. The vulture knew that smell too. Patrick came bounding back, barking, and the vulture reluctantly flapped away. "Not getting me," Lana croaked, but the weakness of her own voice just scared her further. The vultures were going to get her. They were. But there was Patrick, healed after a seemingly fatal wound. Lana laid her left hand on the flesh just above the bone on her right arm. The flesh was hot to the touch. It felt puffy beneath the crust of dried blood. She closed her eyes and thought, whatever did it, however it happened for Patrick, I want it now for me. I don't want to die. I don't want to die. She drifted off then, thinking of home, of her room. She woke with a start from the sound of her own cry. She sat up, as she always did when waking from a nightmare in her own bed. The pain was terrible. Her head pounded, her back, her... She stared at her right arm. For a while, she forgot to breathe, forgot even the pain in her head and back and leg. Forgot them, because the pain in her arm was gone. Her arm was straight, from elbow to wrist. It formed a straight line again. The gangrene was gone as well. The smell of death was gone. I'd usually read a bio of our guests, but for this episode, believe me, nothing online could do justice to Michael's own introduction. Stay tuned, guys. This was a terrific interview. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Spoken World Podcast. On this episode, we have Michael Grant. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Hello. I'm coming to you from beautiful Los Angeles. It's actually a little bit cloudy today, although it usually clears up later in the day. It's warm enough that I'm sitting outside, albeit wearing a sweatshirt. And where I sit, this is my office. I work outside. I mean, you know, unless it's just pouring rain. And I have a place out here. I got a fire pit. For some reason, four chairs sitting around. I have no idea why. There's a giant telephone pole right in my center of my view. But then if you look past that and you pretend the telephone pole isn't there, we have the Griffith Park Observatory and the Hollywood sign visible from here, which is like my little inspirational moment. Every day I go out and look at, I can
like
see
I'm
all
there
that.
With you.
Yeah, like this is the most detailed expression we've ever gotten from any of our guests.
Yeah,
thank
I
you
feel
so
like
much.
I'm there right now.
You're very welcome.
Okay, so let's start at the very beginning. Who is Michael Grant?
Well, not at all what people assume, probably. I come from a, well, let me put it this way. My eldest daughter says my life is non-generalizable, by which she means that nothing I have to say is relevant to anybody else's life if it's based on my life. My life doesn't overlap with any other reasonable person's life. So, army brat growing up, my mother was 16 when she had me. She divorced that guy, my birth father, who I have never met. Got remarried, and when I was about four, I think, to a man called Don Reynolds, who I consider my father because he was there. He's a soldier. I'm going to go see him for his birthday. He's 17. I guess he must be, I don't know, I can't do math, but like 80. So he's old, 82, something like that. 82. So I'm going to see him, going to down to San Diego for his birthday in a couple of days. So grew up all over the place. At age 16, I dropped out of school. I dropped out of high school. I had completed 10th grade. I was the new kid in school every year of my life in school, except for one year I went to school twice. But then 11th grade, again, it was a new school. Things had changed in my head. I had hitchhiked across the country at age 16. I was very independent, didn't particularly like my parents, the family life. I like my dad, okay, my mom's nuts. So I dropped out of high school because my excuse at the moment was that I had walked into the lunchroom. It's like my first day, walked in to have lunch, you know, whatever it was, lasagna. And teacher grabbed me and said, hey, you just came in through the outdoor. And I said, well, okay, I will totally remember that next time. Now I'm going to go get some lasagna. And he said, no, sir, young man, you will march right back out that door and come in the correct door. So I left school. As one does.
You walked out the door and never came back.
Out the door, baby. So then I did various odd jobs. Well, my first job was at Toys R Us. I was a stock clerk at Toys R Us. Worked every hour. I loved work. Loved work. It was like, you know, family life was insane. School was stupid from my point of view. And but work made sense, man. You show up, you do something, and they give you money. It was like, wow, look at that. That's a logical system. I can live with that. So worked there for a few months, took myself and a cashier named Connie to Europe for a couple months, lost Connie en route, ended up coming back through customs carrying nothing but a jar of peanut butter I got from the army commissary in Frankfurt, Germany. All my shit had been stolen. Came back through with a copy of Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End that I lifted from the military library. And a jar of peanut butter and my army coat. And that was it. And I thought, man, that's the greatest trip ever. So I did a bunch of odd jobs. I painted houses. I decorated a little bit with a friend of mine. Did antiques shopping and rehabbing, you know, refinishing antiques, blah, blah, blah. Ended up in D.C. at one point where I became I worked for a law firm there called Wilmer Cutler Pickering. It's Wilmer Hale nowadays. But it's a big Democratic law firm in D.C. So I was there during Watergate, and the law firm was very involved in that whole thing. And I made a teeny tiny minuscule contribution by finding a precedent they were looking for in a university library that was from British common law. And the reason I did it was because I speak French and read French. And it was British law in those days was written in French, you know, because of the Normans. Anyway, long story short, off from that, did various things, got involved in restaurants, started working for restaurant chains, started getting a little weird. I was working 80, 90 hour weeks. I was just obsessed. You know, I loved work. I loved being there. I loved running my ass off. I loved being tired, which of course led to a lot of drinking and a fair amount of drug use. Nothing very exciting, just usual stuff. At some point I decided, well, I'd had enough of this. And so I decided I was going to commit a burglary and steal a bunch of money from another family. which I did. $7,000. I drove with a buddy of mine down to South Bay. I was living in the East Bay, which is the part of San Francisco Bay, well, to the east, obviously. So I drove down to the South Bay and we hit this place. And these are 24-hour restaurants, so it's open the whole time. But I knew that the managers never closed their safes because I was an assistant manager to Sambo's myself, so I knew the routine. So we cut our way through a wall and got in, emptied the safe, $7,000, took off, right? As, you know, again, as one does. So a few years later, and a few months later, I guess, I was living in South Lake Tahoe and decided to do it again, this time on my own, a much more complicated job that required me to cut my way down through the roof. There was a hatch, you know, but I had to pry it up with a crowbar and then drop down into the crawl space, which is, I don't know, about a foot tall, and then slither through the boards. And at one point I had to stop, leave, go to a DIY store, buy a saw, come back, and then saw my way through a couple of beams that were in my way. Did the same thing, dropped down in the office, emptied the safe. I don't know, $10,000 at that point, which I split with some women I knew, friends of mine at the time. I was maybe 23, 24. And so later on, a couple months later, got arrested, not surprisingly. And they, you know, I was arraigned on both charges, two felony charges. Spent 11 days in two different jails, didn't like it much, and decided I'm not going to prison, I'm going to jump bail. So I did. And for the next 22 years, I was a fugitive from justice. Seriously. So I jumped bail, hitchhiked to, and this is where the part where it gets just even weirder. So I've jumped bail, $60,000 bail I've jumped on. I've hitchhiked to Texas on the theory that in those days, nobody from California ever went to Texas. So I thought I'd be safe there. Lived in Austin, slept under a freeway for a while. Finally got a job bussing tables. And then they made me a waiter, got an apartment, a little crappy bug-infested apartment right outside University of Texas in Austin. And one night, as I was coming home from work, I looked up, and the way the thing was set up, it was a two-story apartment block with exterior staircases, you know, leading up to like two or three apartments at a time. So I was heading up mine and I looked over to my left and I happened to see this girl in a window. And it was one of these bizarre moments in life where, and I want to preface this by saying, I don't believe in God. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in anything mystical or supernatural. And yet it felt subjectively like the hand of God had reached down out of the sky, knocked me on the head and said, listen, you stupid little son of a bitch, go meet that girl. So I did. First time, only time in my life I've ever gone around randomly knocking on somebody's door. I went over, knocked on her door, asked to borrow something, which was bullshit, asked her out for a beer, which was not bullshit. And the next day we moved in together and we've been together for 4 years. Yep. Love at first sight.
That was quick.
So Catherine,
you've been together for how long? 40 years.
40 years. At this point, this is Catherine Applegate of K.A. Applegate of Newbery winning the one and only Ivan, and my co-author, obviously, on Animorphs and other stuff before that. But we, we got together pretty quickly and moved to Annapolis, Maryland, for reasons that are too obscure to go into. Waited tables for a long time, did that for like 10 years. We waited tables. Catherine delivered flowers. We managed low-end vacation rentals in Ocean City, Maryland. Moved all over the place. And of course, all the time I'm living under an alias. And Catherine knows. I mean, I told her immediately I wasn't going to, you know, get close to somebody and lie to them. So, you know, I have my own strange morality, obviously. So, so we spent a lot of time doing the various dead end jobs. And at one point when I was probably 33, 34, this would be about 1988, we were cleaning toilets for a living on Cape Cod. So we were cleaning people's homes during the day and offices at night. And at one point, Catherine said, you know, this isn't really working for me. And I said, gee, really? Surprised. You don't like cleaning toilets? So, you know what we should do? We should get careers and maybe even have kids. And of course, I assumed she was joking about that second part. But I said, okay, well, what career? And she said, I think we should become writers. And so I said, okay. And then we did. So we wrote and sold a couple of Harlequin romance novels just to kind of get into the system. But we couldn't, Harlequin couldn't turn those around fast enough for us to make a living. So we started ghostwriting for Sweet Valley Twins. And then we started ghostwriting for a bunch of other shit. So we ghostwrote a ton, like 17 of the Sweet Valley Twins books, a bunch of Girl Talk books. These are ongoing series, you know, monthly series. And then the people we were working with at the time, the packagers, were like, they were seeing the beginnings of something called Young Adult. And it was there's a series called Freshman Dorm and some other, just one or two other things, very little out there on the shelves. There wasn't like a dedicated section for young adult. But we talked to them and decided we were going to do a series set in Ocean City. So that was our first YA series. And we began it in our usual style by rejecting every suggestion that the publishing people made and doing whatever the hell we felt like doing. And it became a small-time hit. And then from there, we did more of that. And then a few years later, when we were, again, broke and fairly desperate, living in Sarasota, Florida, and walking our cat, believe it or not, at night, because why not? We were hoping an alligator would eat it. In any case, we were walking around in steaming heat that you get in Florida and decided... And I was talking to Catherine. She's like, I can't do any more of this series shit. So I said, well, we can't stop doing series because we're still not R.L. Stine, which is who we wanted to be, you know, if we, on the off chance that we grew up. So I said, well, babe, what would you do if you could not worry about marketing or anything else and just do whatever the hell you wanted to do? And she said, I would love to find a way to put kids sort of in the heads of animals, let them have that real experience. And I immediately said, well, that's a science fiction premise. We're going to need aliens. So we invented Animorphs and we sold Animorphs. And then we wrote Animorphs and we wrote Everworld and we wrote Remnants. And at this point, we'd written, you know, well over 100 books, 120 books, something like that. And then when we decided to wrap Animorphs, Everworld, and Remnants, all three series, I took some time off. I did media for the, at that point, as we were wrapping up Animorphs, I then hired a bunch of lawyers out in California and they made everything go away. I mean, literally everything went away. So I'd spent 22 years on the run. And in the end, all charges were dropped. I literally have no criminal record right now, aside from my arrest record. So, but I had reformed, you know, by that point, obviously, and now I was a writer and took some time off from writing. And did political ads for the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee. And then when we were broke again, I decided, we should probably get back to work. And that's when I wrote Gone, which more or less brings us up to the beginning of Gone. How's that for a 15-minute answer?
Well, they usually don't. Like, you don't expect this kind of thing. They never, I don't think it's enough to fit at the back of the book when they go about the author.
Yes.
All of this at the back. Well, it was very interesting. I did not expect it at all.
Oh my God. And what were you up to when you were younger?
You were everywhere.
Oh my God.
We cannot think of
it's a
better
weird
kind of
story.
Experience.
I've actually lived I counted it up one time. I think I've lived in more than 50 homes. And I'm 65, so not quite one a year, because we slowed down when we had kids. We had kids 22 years ago, just about the same time I got clear with the law. Actually, although my daughter is born, she still has her last name is still an alias because the name I was using at the time. And it was about a year, year and a half later that I was finally clear with the law. And, you know, I've always told her you could use any of my many names. If you'd like, you can use Grant, which is a pseudonym, or you can use Reynolds, which is my actual name, my actual last name. And she's like, no, I'm good. So so there's that. Next question.
Okay. Did you always know you were going to be an author? Actually, I don't think you did, but
yes, I don't think.
No. No, but I didn't, but I always knew that I could be, which is, I know sounds arrogant, but like I say, at age 34, literally cleaning toilets, when my wife said we should become writers, it never occurred to me that I couldn't do it. I was immediately like, yeah, probably should, you know, let's do that.
You said it's
more fun than this.
Yeah. You said you hitchhiked at a point in your life.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
How did you connect with your parents again?
Oh, I did after I cleared everything up. So I got back in touch with both my parents, with my mother and my dad and my siblings. I have two younger sisters, one of whom died shortly thereafter of cancer, after having a 2-year-old kid, which is sad. The other sister's still alive. My dad's okay. He's, like I say, down in San Diego. My mom and I don't get along. We didn't before I split, and we didn't when we got back together. There are issues between us that would have required her to be honest about them when I came back. It was like I extended the hand. I paid up, you know, because I thought maybe they'd been hit for the bail. So I paid all that back. But she wasn't prepared to be honest. And I'd reached a point in my life where I'd spent, you know, 2 decades lying. And I just had developed an almost like physical aversion to lying. And it sounds stupid, but it's like if you eat a bad oyster or something, you know, you don't want to eat an oyster again. And it was like I told all the fucking lies I could, you know, for a long time. And I just couldn't anymore. I was just done. And so I was honest with her and was hoping for the same in return, didn't get it. So we are no longer in communication. She lives in France.
Oh, wow. Okay. So yeah. We'll just go back to that was actually pretty intense.
Yes,
we will go back to asking questions about Gone Now.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
When I read the books, I mean, I read them in 2015.
I read them quite recently.
Yeah. I read all 6 books. They gave me a Harry Potter meets Lord of the Flies vibe. And I just want to ask, like, when did you get the idea for the Gone series?
Well, it's so weird. First of all, let me tell you that it was not based on Lord of the Flies, although about halfway through writing the first book, it suddenly dawned on me, and I made the connection. I was living in Italy at the time with Catherine and the kids, and I just remember thinking, this is Lord of the Flies. And I was really pissed off. I was like, oh, God damn it, I'm writing a Lord of the Flies. And now it wasn't anything, you know, the themes aren't the same. There are some superficial similarities. But I hate the idea. I just hate the idea of ever doing anything derivative. I don't ever want to do anything that's like anything anybody else has done ever. That's my approach. I want it to be completely out of my own head. I don't want to take somebody else. I it horrifies me. The idea that I would use somebody else's ideas. But the things that got me kind of thinking about the Gone concept was the TV show Lost, actually. So that was more the inspiration, if you want to use that word. And I realized that, you know, Lost is, it's a desert island story, obviously, you know, but like Robinson Crusoe. But you can go all the way back to, and Lord of the Flies, but you can go all the way back to the expulsion from the Garden of Eden in Genesis. It's essentially the same story. Everything was fine. Everything got taken away. Now what? That's the essential story. And that's the essential story of Gone. Everything was, you know, life was going along. Suddenly everything changes. Everything was taken away. Now what do you do?
Okay.
I was waiting
for an answer. I was like, I was okay. Like, and then I thought this was what was going to happen. So when you found out that you were writing something that was very similar to Lord of the Flies, is that when you now sort of changed the whole Sam and Kane getting at each other?
No, or no, I knew that. No, that was already okay. That was already baked in. That was already baked in. I knew by that point what I was doing, at least for book one. I should tell you, I don't plan books, and I don't plan series in the usual way. In other words, I don't outline them or know how they're going to end or know where the story is going. What I know when I start is that I create what I call a series Bible. And in that series Bible, I have, for example, character sketches. I'll go online and find pictures of people that I think look like they might be the character. I'll put that in and I'll do a description of them, their age, their, you know, their eye color, their hair color, what they like, you know, what kind of music they listen to, what kind of clothing they wear, what's on the wall of their bedroom, all this kind of stuff. You start building up all that detail and pretty soon you get a better picture of the character. And I knew some locations. So I did the same thing with locations. If like the hotel that's used in Gone, Clifftop, is based very much on a real place. I have a picture, you know, so I just kind of said, well, I changed the name slightly. That's that place. And because I can do that, it creates a degree of reality. So like when I'm describing the hotel, I'm describing a real place, not just some place I made up out of my head, but a real place, you know, to some extent. And then, so when I do things like drop the barrier across it, I pull up a plan of it. I pull up Google Maps. I pull up, you know, Google Earth, and I look at it and I work it out, you know, in detail. So what would they see from here? If I stood on this balcony, what would I see? So that kind of planning I do. In other words, I create the geography, I create the basic characters, figure out the essential themes, you know, what we're talking about basically. And then I start the book. So I have kind of an idea and then I start the book. And then how the story progresses from there, though, I don't know. I make it up each time as I go along. So I create all the different plot lines, all the different storylines within the book. And then I hope that it's all going to come together at the end. But amazingly enough, it always seems to come together at the end. I was worried when I wrapped the series at book six, and is it all going to have a satisfying conclusion? And then I got there and I was like, oh, I think this is a pretty good ending. And then, you know, I waited until Goodreads reviews started to light up and went, oh yeah, everybody bought it. Everybody kind of dug it. So I was happy about that, which was just, you know, like, I guess, dumb luck or something.
I don't think it was dumb luck. I think it has to be something more because the idea
it's
of
gift,
it,
it's a yeah, gift. It's a gift. I feel like it's a gift.
The
really.
Series because Bible, I think that's a very brilliant thing. I tried writing a novel when I was younger and I was all over the place, like everywhere. My character could be doing this in the first part and she's like a completely different person. So
yeah,
this was in
that's, but rule, that's rule number one. Rule number one, yeah. You never, ever, ever have any character act out of character. It doesn't matter what you need for the story. If you get to a point where you have to choose between the integrity of the character and telling some particular plot point or story, stick with character.
So the characters have such like powerful roles in the books. I remember having so much respect for Adilio, who was well respected, even though he had,
he, like,
no,
had
powers.
No powers. Yeah.
And even Drake, who still had no powers, but was still feared. I have to ask, like, what's the inspiration behind these characters?
Well,
aside from just finding random headshots on the internet.
Exactly. We're actually more interested in the characters that had no powers.
I'm really glad to hear that because that was quite deliberate. I set out when I looked at this, I'm going to have some characters who have powers and some who don't, but I'm also not going to have a dominance by the characters who have powers. In other words, it's not going to be that simple. It's not going to be you got powers, you're in charge, you don't, you're not. So some of the most important characters, like Albert is probably the most powerful person in the phase by the end. He's feeding everybody. You know, he's keeping the food going. But he has no powers except that he's organized and he's ambitious and he's willing to work hard. That's his superpower. And Adelia was a very deliberate choice. And I don't usually do this, make a character who's there to prove a point. But there was a lot of controversy about immigration in this country. and a lot of dissing of people from south of the border, which I find just intolerable, since the reality is that the United States has been using those people as cheap labor for decades and building our country on the backs of that cheap labor for decades, for over a century, certainly, is that we've been using Mexicans and Salvadorans and Guatemalans and stuff. And then we turn around, having used their cheap labor, having exploited them, we turn around and shit on them every 10 years and decide we got to push them back over the border. And I just, yeah, so I was making a point with Adelio. I wanted him to be, to start off as a character who had no friends, no connections, no status. You know, he's an undocumented Honduran kid. And I slowly built him over the course of 6 books into being probably the most relied upon, most respected character in the phase. So that was deliberate. I was making a point with that. So I wanted that kind of disparity in power. I needed the imbalance of power, but I also needed kids who would rise above, you know, without powers, who would nevertheless excel. So that was the idea. And then with Astrid, I originally was going to give her a power. I did kind of in book one, and then changed my mind and just hoped nobody would notice. Well, they noticed.
She was a 2-bar, and then nobody talked about it again.
I know.
The thing is, like, your power is meant to grow, but hers just stopped.
So I decided I could either like bullshit my way around that or just kind of move on past it, because I had changed my mind by then. And what I wanted Astrid to be, her power is she's smart. You know, it's as simple as that. She's highly intelligent, ruthless, you know, very, very good at prioritizing, you know, knows what matters to her at any given point. So when I start off with character, this is a bit more on process. I kind of think of them as being positional characters. In other words, the position of male lead, the position of female lead, you know, whatever, however I'm constructing the thing. So I started off in this case, I thought, well, I'd written so many books. I've still, by the way, to this day, written more books under a woman's pseudonym than I have as a man. So I've written more books as a woman than I have as a man. Oddly enough, and I'd written so many books with female leads, I thought, well, let's do a male lead for Gone. So I decided on, you know, I had an idea what I wanted, so I got that picture. Well, then the first question is, okay, now I got Sam. Who does Sam talk to? I need people for Sam to talk to. Let's give him a girlfriend, Astrid. Let's give him a best friend, Quinn. Now he's got people to talk to. Now we've got dialogue. Now we have a relationship, right? So then I've got a dynamic to work with within those three people, which is where we start with that kind of little group. And on the other side, on the evil side, there's Kane, Diana, and Drake, which are kind of the mirror image of them. So from there, those are my positional characters. Those are the people I need. The other character I needed was Lana, for very practical reasons. I needed to be able to have a lot of action, which is, you know, euphemism for violence, and not have everybody dead within a week. So I needed some way to get people back in the fight, so to speak. So I needed a healer. Mary was another basically positional character, because I knew I had little kids and I didn't want to have to mess with them all the time. You know, I wanted them kind of out of the way. So I came up with Mary in order to handle the children, which so I could use them when I wanted to use them, and but still have them, you know, safely put away somewhere where I don't have to deal with them in every, you know, on every page.
Wow. I was going to ask about other characters, but we could just go on and on. I mean, there was Dara that was in charge of the hospital, and the other characters that we had to go through. But we'll just go to the next question. Yeah.
Okay, so the Gone series has 6 books in total, mm-hmm. ending with Light. Was it easier starting the book or coming up with the context for the next book?
Oh, starting is always easy. That's to me anyway. When I start a book, and sometimes I have only a sketch of an idea, and I'll just start writing, because when you start writing, you quickly discover what you need. So, you know, you'll start writing and go, okay, well, blah, 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 dialogue. Where are they? Oh, they need to be a place. Let's invent a place. Now we put them in the place, and then we continue. We write a little bit further in, and we may say, you know, I feel I need a character to do something for me here. I need somebody to be over there doing that. And so I'll invent a character to be over there doing that, whatever that is. And then that becomes part of the story. So you find out pretty quickly by sitting down and actually writing what it is you need in order to do the story, what you're going to need to put the whole thing together.
What? Like, okay, the adults are gone. The world as they know it is gone, as well as there's also mutation of plants and animals and themselves. Uh-huh. But there's one particular thing that just stuck out to me that I have to ask. What made you decide that the age limit should be 14?
We went back and forth on that, or I did. I originally was going to have it be 13. And my thinking was, and this is just, you know, I don't know. It was like the age of bar mitzvah. You know, it's the age of adulthood, supposedly, at least in the Jewish tradition and a lot of other traditions. When a young man is 13, you know, that's the transition point. And I was kind of tying it into, you know, puberty and adulthood. And then I looked at it and went, dude, this is way too much for 13-year-olds. You got to bump it up a little bit. Now, in fairness, a lot of people were trying to get me to push it up to, you know, 16 or 18. And I knew that was going to kill it. I knew it had to be younger. So I was trying to find a sweet spot. Also, if I'd gone older, I feel if I'd gone significantly older, the books would have been much more about people having sex and having babies, which I didn't want. That was just not something that interested me.
I knew
they couldn't be 18 because that destroys the fear factor of the whole thing. Because, you know, if you see a kid who's 11 years old walking down the street with a gun in one hand and a bottle of vodka in the other, that's scary. But if you see an 18-year-old doing it, it's just Los Angeles on any given night. So you need to, you know, the fear comes from the youth, from the vulnerability. But I had to find that kind of sweet spot in between, and 14-15 bump seemed like the place to go.
So I have to ask this because it's like my favorite quote in the Gone series ever. I remember it was from the book Fear.
Uh-huh.
I can't exactly remember who Sam was talking to, but it was like, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is the king.
Yeah.
And then Sam replied, but in the darkness, the one man holding a candle is a target.
Yeah, the first part of
it. It was really deep. Like, at that point, like, it was really intense because Sam is so scared of the dark, even though his powers are, he can blast lights from his hand. And then the dome that they were living under inside, whatever, was turning really, really dark. So it was cutting out like their light. And then everyone was looking up to Sam to step up. But he's like, he was really scared of that and he didn't want to. As did you think of this quote before creating
the situation?
No.
Or did the situation warrant that quote?
The first part of that, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, is a quote from somebody else. I lifted that. The second part is me.
Yeah.
So I could look it up, but I don't remember who the quote's from. But in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And then the response, you know, but basically, you know, in the land of people who can see, the dumbass holding a candle is a fucking target, isn't it? So that was the kind of the counterpoint to that. But I'm glad you enjoyed that. That book was originally going to be called Darkness. And then, because, you know, I wanted to go Darkness, then Light for the final book. Well, unfortunately, Darkness didn't fit on the cover, so we renamed it Fear.
That was why you changed it to Fear.
What?
It didn't fit on the cover.
My editor's like, you know, that doesn't really fit on the cover. I'm like, oh, damn, you're right. It doesn't. It's too long.
I think we have to call it something now.
we'll call it Fear. So I kind of, and we decided that fairly early on in the process. So I was just a few chapters in, I think, when we made that realization. And so I changed the name to Fear and then changed, you know, used Darkness. But the theme was, you know, was that the fear and the helplessness, because there's nothing more, you know, helpless than a person who can't, you know, tell what's going on around them. This isn't like, you know, they weren't blind like blind people who are, you know, are raised to adapt and learn ways to adapt to being sightless. These were, you know, people who'd relied their entire life on being able to see, then suddenly deprived of it. And that's just a terrifying situation. It's all a metaphor for death. You know, as you approach death, it gets darker and darker and darker. But then in this case, we had light. Ta-da!
In the form of Sam. Okay, so what final message do you have for our listeners and people like me who started writing books but like made a mess out of it? What advice do you have to, for us?
Well, okay, first of all, the barriers to entry in writing have never been lower. This is the first time in history that you can just write something, put it up online, and have people read it. You don't have to get through an editor or anything else. Unfortunately, this also means you don't get paid. So I think thing one, you have to decide which track you're on. Are you looking to write as a hobby? Are you looking to write for your own entertainment? Are you looking to write so that your friends will enjoy a story that you've come up with? Or are you looking to make a living? And those are two very different approaches. So if you're doing the first thing, you know, have at it, do what you want to do. Write whatever the hell you want, write it as long or as short as you want. You have that freedom. If it's the second track and you actually want to get paid, then it's a different story. Then you have to be aware of things like length, what's available in the market, what other people are doing to a certain extent. The best piece of advice I ever got early on was to go to Barnes & Noble, which is the big, you know, bookstore chain. Go to the section that you think your book should be in and take a look at the shelf and tell yourself and ask yourself, will my story fit here? In other words, if I'm looking at books that are all 300 pages long and mine is 900 pages long, I'm probably going to have trouble. And the reverse. I can't go in there and say, I got a 25 page story. Let's make it a book. So just at the level of length, as a starting point, you have to decide what you're looking at. But so first of all, be aware of the market. And don't kid yourself. You know, when you start off, you're nobody special. And no, some editor is not going to look at your manuscript and go, oh my God, it's the next J.K. Rowling. And I realize it's not very good, but I'll fix it. No, none of that happens. What you need to do is when you write your book or short story, whatever it is, before you submit it for publication, do your absolute best work. I mean, over and over and over again until you're absolutely sure you've got it right. You've got it where you want it to be. Then you submit it to an agent, and then the agent submits it to a publisher, and then the editor of the publisher gets back to you and says, here's what we like and here's what we don't like. And at that point, you already need to know your shit well enough to know what's going to work and what isn't going to work, right? Because they're going to tell you things, and sometimes they're right and sometimes they're wrong, and you need to know the difference.
Wow, this has been such an amazing conversation, Michael. I didn't actually expect this when I asked you to come on the show, and I'm so grateful and that insightful. You accepted to like come on the show. Like when you said yes, let's do it, I was like, ah, he actually replied.
So I yeah. have a confession before we stop. I have been planning and struggling with writing for a blog.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. And this conversation has helped me put a lot of things in perspective.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try writing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe next week. But I will try.
Don't be intimidated by writing. You know, because again, this is I think the useful example that I can offer you. I'm a high school dropout. I was cleaning toilets, in trouble with the law, having to write under a pseudonym and pretend to be somebody else, and somehow I made it. Now, if I can make it under those circumstances, the hell is your excuse? You know?
And that is it, folks. Thank you so much for listening till the end. Thank you to everyone who has been, you know, so loyal to the show, despite the fact that there has been a lot of inconsistencies. But there are new episodes definitely that will be rolling out. So it's going to be going on a weekly basis. So guaranteed you're going to have another episode next week. And yeah, follow us on the Spoken World podcast on Instagram at The Spoken World, Twitter at the same name, The Spoken World. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, opinions, definitely hit us on Twitter, Instagram, or just send us an email at thespokenworldpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to be a guest, use the same channels. Please rate us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. We really, really, really need that. There are links in the show notes to find out more about Mike Wilson, Aaliyah Chaplin, and Pages. All right then, till next time, it's your girl Hua from Nigeria.